Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to Upstart Crow. I'm William Miller. My guest today is Catherine Nixey. She studied classics at Cambridge University and works as a journalist at The Economist in England. Her writing has appeared not only in The Economist, but also in The Times and The Financial Times. She also is the author of two books, The Darkening Age, which was an international bestseller and a New York Times notable book, and which won a Royal Society Award for nonfiction, and the book we are here to discuss today, Heretic, Jesus Christ and the Other Sons of God. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me.
In the book, you talk about your background, and you are the daughter of a former monk and nun who left their orders and met each other, got married, that kind of thing. You also talk about how at one point you thought that God was Peter because throughout Mass, as you were reared a Catholic, you seem to say at intervals, "Thanks, Peter God."
Yes, yes. If anyone has been brought up Catholic, you know that you don't sort of get it, and nothing's really explained to you. You just go to church, do the signs, like, you know, say the words, and it can all be quite confusing. And so we went to church a lot. As you say, my mother had been a nun, my father had been a monk, and for quite a long time as well, about 24 years between them of Godding. And then they'd come out, they'd met each other. My father had left the monastery, and then they'd had kids. So we went to church, and I think there must have been a bit of them that assumed we knew what on earth was going on, and we really didn't. So as a child, I did. My brother's called Peter as well. So I think the idea of this like vengeful superpower who was called Peter also seemed completely plausible to me because he's an older brother. So you know what kids are like. So when we said, thanks be to God, I had just totally misheard it. So, and for years thought that this was, for years, probably when I was tiny, thought that this was God's first name.
I was telling a friend of mine where I live that I was going to be talking with you today, and she also was reared Catholic. And when I told her this anecdote, she just laughed. And she said when she was a child, reared in the Catholic Church, she was learning the Lord's Prayer, and she got to the part about lead us not into temptation, and she heard lead us not into temptation.
These mishearings are, when I talk to other Catholics, there's a famous, somebody wrote a book, I think, was it Roddy Doyle, wrote a book called A Monk Swimming, because he misheard, blessed art thou amongst women, as blessed art thou a monk swimming, and just was like, why is there a monk swimming in that? There's no one really to ask, and there's no moment to ask. I think a lot of religion kind of accretes, and I mean, I guess this is perhaps partly why this is interesting to people, these mishearings. A lot of religion is accretion. A lot of it is mistakes. A lot of it is not there in the original texts. And a lot of the time you neither feel that it's the right moment to ask about it for clarity or that you are the person to question anything. So I think partly this is, I put that in there partly because it's interesting to other Catholics. I think they can associate it with it. But also I think that there is a kind of slightly bigger point attached to that.
Well, my bigger point or my bigger takeaway is that it speaks to the nature of knowledge for me, that we each individually, but also largely, the larger group of us, whatever that group might be, a simple knowledge. We construct it, you know, that knowledge is a constructed thing. I almost want to call it a constructed artifice, but it doesn't exist in the way that we think of artifice, but it is constructed. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a quote in the book from a historian who I like very much in the introduction, and he's a historian called E.H. Carr. He's an extremely interesting man. He was there at the signing of the Treaty of Versailles at the end of the First World War, a very junior member of the British government. But he then went on later in his life to reflect on history and what is history. And he said, historical facts, like we think that they're all there, all laid out for the historian, ready for them just to sort of put into their books. And he said, they're not. They are much closer. It's better to think of them as fish swimming about in a vast and inaccessible ocean. And what you pull up depends in part on simply where you fish. And so the point of the books that I have written is that I am in both of them, I think, fish, particularly the first one, actually, probably fishing in waters that people haven't particularly fished in. So my first book was about more or less what the Romans thought of the Christians, brackets, not very much. And this book is about all the other Christian stories that didn't make it into the modern day, but that have actually influenced us. And in both cases, there are loads and loads of really, really interesting stories, but that just tend to get left out of the history books because they're not where people go fishing. People fish in the other waters. They think, you know, they fish in the like Romans hating the Christians and like throwing them to the lions' waters. They don't, or they fish in the, the Christians arrived and then Christianity took over. And these are the facts that get recycled again and again and again. But actually, if you go to a different bit of the history books or to some of the books that aren't open very much, one of the things that I noticed in when I was researching both of these books is that two of the most interesting books I used, there was only one copy in the library that I was going to. And in both cases, they were kind of falling apart. One of them was literally held together with a shoestring. And when you had to take the shoestring, it was a huge book. You had to take you two hands to carry it over to the table in Cambridge University Library. And then when you took the shoestring off, all the pages just kind of went there. And the librarians were really cross with you if you photocopied it because you would make it fall apart even more. But these were not commonly accessed or used texts in some cases. Like, you know, somebody who studies this will say, well, they're extremely common to us. And they are. To the tiny handful of scholars who specialize them, they're common. But for the bulk of students, bulk of historians who are history at university or reading about it, they're not that common.
Well, and there's several points that I want to underscore in what you're saying. One is you did research. Your research was in the library, not the field, so to speak. I mean, you're doing what I would call secondary research, where you're looking at primary or in some cases secondary. So you're doing tertiary research. You're synthesizing and assembling your own knowledge about these primary and secondary sources. And so it's not just you who's saying these things is one thing. But you're synthesizing and you're constructing, and the books are constructions. And in that sense, they are artifacts. And I think you're right in terms of the quote that you chose seems very well informed and particularly appropriate to the analogy of where you fish and what you get. You're satisfied in terms of, I want to talk about your research process for just a few moments before we delve into what came up. How did you find that book with the shoestring in the Cambridge Library and why that particular book as opposed to one or two others? What led you in the process to that particular book?
I am always particularly interested in the things that people haven't written about. I am interested in the untold stories, the sort of slightly the quieter voices that are nonetheless fun. So the book with the shoestring on is The Theodosian Code. Now, that is not, to people who know about this area, that's not a recherche volume, but it is not as nowhere near as well studied as it should be because it's completely fascinating. It's a huge compendium of laws from the late Roman Empire, and it's absolutely fascinating if you read through it. It tells you so much. It tells you about what Roman views were on whether people should wear purple or not. It tells you on whether you're allowed to wear trousers within the vicinity of Rome. It tells you about what happens to your wife if she's caught having an affair with a slave. Brackets, very unpleasant things all round. You know, it's telling you, it's giving you a huge amount of texture about the Roman Empire. What people tend to read, I mean, what I should say is that, first of all, this period, the period I write about is, again, for most people, just not that studied. So classicists will tend to study the years BC and the first couple of centuries AD, and then they kind of lose interest when Christianity arrives. Christianity does focus on this, but focuses on it really particularly from a Christian point of view. So they don't tend to look as much in the non-Christian texts because they're interested in Saint Augustine, or they're interested in Saint Jerome. They're interested in the texts from their own team, as it were. So there was a neglected vein of stuff that was Roman from a Roman point of view, from what we would call today a pagan point of view. But I have issues with that word. And it just was sort of more untouched. And the other author who I loved was somebody called Celsus. Again, kind of pretty unpopular author. He's becoming more so actually in the past sort of 5 or 10 years, maybe he's becoming more read. But he was a huge and powerful critic of Christianity in the Roman Empire, and he was extremely rude. So the thing that struck me about Celsus, I came across him in the British Library. And a lot of the time when you're doing history, you're reading the same old stuff. You're reading that kind of stuff that feels like Livy, or the stuff that feels like, battles and wars and soldiers and, the usual. Every so often, you find someone who it feels like you're putting your hand out across the centuries and you almost feel you could touch their fingers. And I had that feeling with Celsus. He was saying criticisms of Christianity that I felt I could have heard someone say who was sitting in the pew next to me in church. He was saying, if you need to believe in God to be saved, then why did God take so long to send Jesus? And why did he send him to su such a backwater?
I think he also said, if I remember what you wrote about him, his sayings, what about all those people before that? What about all the people in the BC period?
Yes, exactly. What about all those poor people who didn't know about Jesus? And then he says, why didn't God send him? And then he says, did he just forget? And then he says things like, why did he send him? Why did he have a child with Mary? Why did God have a child with Mary? Romans are sort of snobby about this kind of thing. So he writes in Greek, but let's call him a Roman because he's writing in the Roman Empire. He says, he was God. He could have anyone. Why did he go for some like kind of more or less nothing, nobody in a nothing, nowhere town in the East of Empire? And he has other things as well. Like the thing that was very much I used in the second book is I was brought up to believe that Christianity had been this total change, that it had kind of revolutionized the way that people thought about gods and deities and what gods would do. Because you're kind of taught that the Greeks and Romans had these ridiculous polytheistic gods, Zeus, Hera, Jupiter, Apollo, that were all running around and behaving badly. But then here comes this wonderful, healing, holy Christian God. But when you read Celsus, on the contrary, what you find is that the world is awash with healing, holy gods, saviors who claim to be sons of God, who can put their healing hands on you, who can drive out your demons, who can raise the dead. This was absolutely standard in the East of the Roman Empire at this time. And Celsus lays into the Christians for this very, very heavily. And that, again, I found completely eye-opening.
One such person that you cite is Apollonius.
Yes, Apollonius, who Christians did not like very much. They called him an antichrist. And when you hear his story, you can hear why. I mean, somebody was reading my book and they were like, oh, it's basically the life of Brian with footnotes. And I think that's like not a terrible way to think about it. So Apollonius is the absolute number one in the life of Brian. He is Brian. So Apollonius is born in the east of the Roman Empire at around the same time as Jesus. When his mother is pregnant, she receives a visit from a divine being who tells her that the child that she bears is not mortal. It's that it's a descendant of a god. Perhaps, later people say he's even a god himself made flesh in human form. So the similarities go on. When he's born, a miraculous sign appears in the heavens above his birthplace. As he grows, he has long hair, linen robes, walks about barefoot. He's involved in healing, miraculous healings. He even raises somebody from the dead. He does so in a way that's almost a verbatim kind of similarity to a passage in the Gospel of Luke. It on and on and on. At the end of his life, he's put on trial by towards the end of his life, he's put on trial by the Roman authorities. His friends beg him not to go. He goes anyway. He actually isn't put to death, but death would have been his penalty. He reappears to his friends who don't believe him. They say they have to touch him, like Doubting Thomas. They touch him, they believe he's real. And then in the end of his life, he ascends into heaven. So Christians did not like Apollonius. And there is some evidence that they would have suppressed texts of his. They certainly didn't seem to go to huge lengths to copy them out. They certainly didn't make a big deal of him. But there was a theory among Christians in this period that what had happened was that Satan had sent Apollonius to make Christians doubt. And he was a sort of raw topic, even in the Enlightenment in Britain. So 17th century or so, 18th century, if you wrote about him, you could create a lot of anger among Christians because they felt that it was threatening.
And that's why they didn't like him, because his story was too parallel. It had too much going for it, and it would siphon off some of the energy that they were trying to build up their church with.
Yes, exactly. They call him an antichrist, a kind of, which is a sort of opposite kind of thing. But in fact, what a better thing is, he's a sort of parallel Christ. And the thing is, either Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, or he is not. There is not the opportunity in Christianity for having options of deities like there was in the ancient world. In the ancient world, you could dabble. You could be a bit this, a bit that, a bit Christian, from the point of view of an ancient believer. Christianity insisted on sort of fidelity to its own message. So it is very threatening to them if they're saying, and you can see this panic in the ancients, or panic, anger, outrage in the ancient Christian sources. So if they are saying this is the way, the only way, the only truth, if there's someone else who looks very similar, that's very undermining of your message that you are unique in some way.
Yeah. Well, yes, you've got to have that uniqueness. And you also make mention in the book of the Nag Hammadi manuscripts.
Yes, which again are fascinating because, well, they're found in a jar in the 1940s in Egypt. The story is very conflicted, but anyway, but basically what seems to happen is they find a jar, they open it up, they find these notebooks inside, which are perfectly bound in leather. They look like those lovely tourist notebooks you buy, which have lovely soft floppy leather and then a thing around. They're extraordinarily well preserved. And what you find when you read them is retellings of the biblical stories we know from the Bible, but with a different twist on them. So you find things like there are stories in which there are other deities in heaven with God, and then they criticize God. It's somebody described it as a bit like a kind of jazz riff on the Gospels. You have the Gospels or the Bible stories that we know, maybe the story of Eden. And then these Christians are writing around them, writing in conflict with them, questioning them. And what's interesting is not so much the stories, because I think if you don't believe, then none of these stories are correct for you. None of them are what we call, would think of as truth. What's interesting is that there was a form of Christianity that seemed to think it was acceptable to tell and retell stories in a different way. And that feels revelatory because for Christians, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and that kind of singularity has spread to a lot of Christian thought that there is the Bible. I mean, the Bible is actually comes from a Greek word, which is plural. It's really more of a library than a book. But there is this idea that there is only one story, one way, one word. And what all of these things do is they say that in the beginning, there was not the Word. In the beginning, there was really quite a lot of words, and many of them disagreed with each other. And this is a very, very threatening thing to find. Each time these books are uncovered, more books are uncovered, you get a sort of huge response within theologians, within Christianity itself.
Well, and that does bring us then sort of to the question of, well, how did the Bible come to be? I mean, I know that you have talked about how it wasn't an editorial process. It wasn't like newspapering, for example, where someone said, okay, this is in, this is in, this is out, this is out. But it wasn't entirely unlike that. There were assemblages. The late 300s AD, there was an assemblage. And then again, in Florence, I think around the 1400s, that was kind of codified. And I know, you know, this is the King James version of the Bible. And then since then, there's been the Revised Standard. And I know if you now look on the internet, you'll find that a lot of the Protestant churches have gotten together and found a Bible that they can stand behind, a number of them. And they call it, quote, the very breath of God, close quote. So, I mean, they really are. So the fact that the church speaks of it as a kind of unified and unifying document, if you will.
Yes, no, you are. And definitely books were kicked out of it. The two things that I find really interesting, the person when I was saying it's not like a newspaper process, that was quoting M.R. James, who translated a lot of these texts. M.R. James was a kind of extremely, extremely good, but also extremely dislikable English scholar who translated many of these texts and kind of put them into a single book that there's now called the Apocryphal Gospels, I think was the title of his book. And he said, it's not like a newspaper editor. That's not how it happened. You know, he didn't actually go on to say how he thought it. I think his feeling was that the Bible was there already and this was the wrong stuff. So it was never going to go in. And there is an element to that sort of the Christians of Rome, who Roman Catholicism descended from, that they had sort of something very close to what we would have called the Bible. But there were lots of other Christian groups who had different texts. And as well as that, there were these sort of kind of, to modern minds, there's no real analogy of it, but these other texts that were sort of also accepted. And I write about these in my book, but there's a very, very important one called the Proto-Evangelium of James, which tells about the birth of Jesus, which perhaps we'll come on and talk about that. That's hugely important. There were other ones that told of Jesus's life while he was a small boy. And these, while they are not in the Bible, that doesn't mean they're not important. I think what the difficulty for modern Christians is that you think, well, if you're a Christian, you've got the Bible, and what's in the Bible is what you believe. But just consider some modern things that people think are in the Bible. Like the apple in Eden, say, or, you know, that there is a concept of hell within the Bible. There is no concept of hell in the New Testament like we know hell, not the sort of flames and fiery pit proportional punishment place. That's not there. Or think of something as simple as the Lord's Prayer. So, our Father who art, which art in heaven, but, you know, that give us this day our daily bread. That word daily does nobody knows really what it means. There is a kind of, it's a very complicated Greek philosophical word, which is then not quite transliterated, but put into Latin. It does not mean, we don't know what it does mean. What it absolutely very clearly doesn't mean is daily. So in the point of me thinking that God is called Peter as a child or things like this, religions acquire things as they go along, which become fundamental to what a lot of people believe that they are and what they believe in, like hell. I mean, you know, anyone who's brought up an Irish Catholic or like my people in my family were 100 years ago, they would have been very certain that hell was a very big part of Christianity. It's just not there. So texts are not all of a religion. We think because we've got a religion of the book, it is all about the book, and it isn't. And just a final point is most people couldn't read the book. For most people, it was really a fiction. You know, it didn't exist. They've done a projection. Somebody said, how many Christians were there, say, in the year 100 AD? They did a projection. If Christianity had grown exponentially every year of its existence, by the year 100 AD, there would be only 7,000 Christians. Of those 7,000, maybe 50 would be fully literate. That's a kind of generous estimate. And that is when the Bible is being decided. So it's a tiny, tiny, tiny group of specialists all around the Mediterranean who are making these choices.
And that means that a lot of the people who were practicing Christians in that time period were working out of an oral tradition. They were working out of what they heard. Lead us not into temptation, and Peter God notwithstanding.
Yes, exactly. It's an oral tradition with all of the vicissitudes that an oral tradition will bring. And, you know, there's a very persuasive argument to say that it's taking in things from other traditions. There's miracles of Asclepius. I mean, you don't even have to. Apollonius is very contested. The only text that we have of Apollonius that survives comes from around 300, I think, AD. There is a lot of evidence to imply that there were earlier texts. We don't have them. It'd be fascinating if one was ever discovered. But there are other texts. You know, there's a novel that we know was published before the Bible, which contains a scene in it very like at the scene when people go into Jesus's tomb and he's not there and the stone's been rolled away. So what is going on? You know, there are healings of Asclepius where he lays on healing hands and people are, the lame are cured, the blind see, people are raised from the dead. This is happening in texts and in oral traditions all the time. It seems, I think the most likely thing is, it's not particularly that anyone's copying someone else, but these find their way into Christianity.
Well, the important thing I think here is that Jesus was born into the world. And as you say in the book, there were healings. There were other people. There were other long-haired, bearded guys walking around barefoot doing things.
Yes.
In various places of the world. And there were stories written about them and told about them. And at first they were told and then they got written down. And I forget who it was, but you quote someone as pointing out that the original people talking about Jesus, as well as these other people who were doing other, these are mostly men doing other things, they were storytellers. And in some ways, they were inventors of the stories they were telling. You're sitting there, you're telling a story, you're looking at your audience, whether it's one person or 100 people, you're looking at them and they're nodding and their eyes are getting big and they're going along and you start embellishing your story, right? That's part of the oral tradition.
Yeah, it sounds very plausible. I have no idea how the oral tradition, we have more idea how the oral tradition worked in things like Homeric Greece, Homeric poems in Greece. I don't know how the oral tradition worked in things like this, but what we can say is that there are snippets that look extremely similar, and that these are character types that are appearing again and again in texts across the Mediterranean at this period, to the point when you said long hair, so Jesus appears in lots of images with long hair. Long hair is so much a sign of a holy man that the satirists in this period, the Roman satirists, you don't get really Christian satirists, you don't really get humor in Christian texts, which I think is interesting in itself, that they make fun of people. So there's somebody who's claiming to have divinity from and his ancestors. He's claiming to be able to heal people. He founds a religion because he wants to make money. They all see money in this, the critics, but he hasn't got the hair. So what does he do? Well, he gets hair extensions. It is so so much a type, a trope, that you can mock it. And I think that in itself is interesting, you know. And they mock people who have disciples. The Greek word is discipulos. It means pupils. It's people who are following you. All of these words that we think of as very Christian words, like gospel comes from, gospel is a much later word, but it comes from euangelion, which is the kind of good news. But that word phrase was used of Augustus, the Emperor Augustus, who, by the way, also had miraculous beginnings in his life before he was born. You know, it goes on and on. These stories are in the water.
Let's talk about some of the other I'm kind of two minds here, but one was some of the things that are missing. You make mention of the fact that when you were a little girl, you would help your mother prepare the manger scene, and that part of what you guys put into it and part of what we see as traditional manger scene things aren't in the Bible. They're not in the Gospels. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, so this is something I would do with my mum every Christmas. We put out, like a lot of Catholics, I think, we put out our crib with its sort of little pink baby Jesus and it had an ox and an ass, and it had Joseph, and it had the three wise men, and it had sheep, and it had, because we were Catholic, because Catholics like to overdo things, we had like multicolored fairy lights on it too, I think. No, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. But what is interesting is that some of the things in that just are not in the New Testament. So a lot of what we think of as the Christian story comes, in fact, from this book known as the Proto-Evangelium of James. And it was a gospel that told about the story of the birth of Jesus in much more detail than you get in the Bible. The Bible really bounces over the birth of Jesus very quickly. But this one goes into considerable detail. And what it tells you about is it says that Mary and Joseph were going along, and Mary is on a donkey. They're going again to be counted. Mary is heavily pregnant, and and she's on the donkey, and then she says, "Oh, I, the child that is in me is pressing to come out." So they find somewhere for her to give birth, and they find a cave. And this had always puzzled me as a child. Where's the cave from? The cave is from this. It's not in the Bible. It is in this. Let's call it the Book of James. It's easier. And so they go into the cave, and Mary is giving birth. And by good luck, they also find a midwife. So they find a midwife. So Joseph leaves, as men would in those days, goes outside to just sort of look at the sky and pass the time while Mary's inside giving birth with the midwife. And while it's a beautiful telling, actually, because while Joseph is standing outside, you have to have some way of describing what's happening inside. And what happens is the world stops. It literally stops turning. So he's looking at a shepherd who's raising his arm to hit his flock. And the shepherd's arm becomes frozen in midair. He's looking at the birds that are flying across the sky, and they freeze in midair. And then he's looking at the stars, and even the stars have stopped moving across the sky. So the world has stopped turning. This miraculous child has been born. And he goes, and this action cuts back to Mary and the midwife. And this is a kind of very striking tale. So what happens is that the midwife is very excited. Mary's given birth, and she runs outside and she says, "A virgin has given birth." And a woman is walking past outside, and the woman says, "I don't believe a virgin's given birth. I won't believe it till I come and thrust my hand in search for the parts." In other words, "I won't believe this till I give Mary a virginity test." And the midwife, I think very much not to her credit, says, "Okay, come on." And so she brings her in. And then the woman, Mary, as always, doesn't get a say in any of this. So the woman inserts her hand into Mary's vagina. So we don't know what Mary thinks, but the response of her vagina is absolutely unambiguous because it burns the woman's hand off. And the woman takes her hand out and she says, "Whoa," you know, as you would. And this text changed the character of the Catholic Church. It is from this text they think that the cult of the Virgin Mary that you see in kind of European countries, that it comes from this. It doesn't come from the Bible. And it is also from this text that you get the ox and the donkey, because they're not in the New Testament. They aren't in the story of Mary and Joseph. They seem to only come from this. And so whenever you see a nativity painting with an ox or an ass, whenever you sing, I don't know if you sing it in America, the song Little Donkey, where Mary's walking on a donkey, that's not from the Bible. That's all come from this text, which was enormously important, enormously popular. It's one of the most attested manuscripts from this period. And yet we kind of forgot about it.
Did we forget, or did we just push it to the side because it does have some unfortunate aspects to it? Burning hands and all that?
Burning hands and virginity tests, yeah. Like, it definitely fell out of favor. And when it was rediscovered, they sort of rumbled along these texts, and then somebody called William Hone, who is great fun. He's a journalist and he's working in Britain in around 1820. And he's in the British Library researching something else. Well, it was the British Museum in those days, but it doesn't matter. It's basically the British Library. And he reads this and he's like, what? You know, and he just instantly realizes the value of what he's reading. So he rushes out. He says he tears the page out. He can't have torn the page out. He tears the page out, runs to the printers and reprints it. And the outrage is astonishing. He sort of spends the rest of his life defending himself for having printed this. And it is an absolute bestseller and a sensation from the beginning. And it never goes out of print. And it is huge, again, because people had been taught that this was the word of God. And here are all the other words of God. And actually, brackets, here are the words of God that explain some of the things you know better than the things in the Bible, because there is the ox and the ass in this story. Or say in another story, there's things that explain hell, which again isn't in the Bible as we know it. So two things kind of run through the history of this is firstly, that if you kind of fish in different places, you get good rewards. Like Hone became very famous or infamous perhaps for doing this. But he also got massively pilloried. People were furious with him. And he tried to answer the critics, which is possibly also a mistake. But he gets really angry with what he calls their disingenuous criticism, because what they do is they attack him personally, when in truth, what is so bothersome to Christians and the reason they're so angry and the reason they're attacking him is that it's the history that they don't like.
The aspects of the story.
Yeah.
And is that why the Bible, do you think, leaves out those unfortunate parts, those questionable parts, those aspects of the story that are so bothersome?
Why did the original people who were writing the gospel, the gospels were kind of, so if we assume Jesus died in around AD 30, the gospels are starting to, in their form, the earliest one dates from maybe 70, the latest from like kind of 110 AD probably. I don't think they so much leave it out as they're telling a different story. Some of these texts, some of these apocryphal gospels, they come in later to fill in what we see as holes in the Bible.
Well, and in fact, not every Bible has the same number of texts within it or books within it, because the Protestant Bibles leave out some of those apocryphal texts that some of the others include.
Yeah, exactly. And even now there are differences. If you go to Ethiopian Coptic Christianity, they will have different texts in theirs that are just not in ours. And I think it was never in our tradition. There's a story about how Jesus resurrects a cockerel from a chicken dinner that's being eaten and sends it into the sky for 1,000 years. You know, and that is still read today. But that's just definitely not in the tradition that we've got.
And that cockerel also spies on Judas.
Yes, it's a great cockerel. It's part of the story. It's a great story. It's a really great fun story. Yeah. And he goes to spy on Judas and kind of reveals everything that's going to happen. It's a glorious story. It is, to the minds of people who read it, coming from a Western Christian tradition, the sort of part of Christianity that survived in the West, it feels wrong. And I think that's the difficulty with reading about this, is that some stories look to you, in inverted commas, wrong. There's a wonderful quote from, a Jesuit priest who turns up somewhere, I think it's Ethiopia, maybe Ethiopia in like sort of 14th, what century? I don't know, 14th century. Anyway, there's a priest who turns up and he's astonished not only that he's found Christians, but that they seem to think that their Christianity is correct. And this is something that runs through the whole of this story, that there is, inverted commas, right Christianity and that there is wrong Christianity. So my book's called Heresy. And the word heresy basically meant, in ancient Greece, it meant choice. But it came to mean something very ugly in Christianity. And in Christianity, it came to be tainted with the idea that there is a right choice and that there is a wrong choice. Whereas in ancient Greece, by contrast, to commit a heresy, to use your mind to make an intellectual decision and to take a position, to make a hieresis, an intellectual choice, was seen as one of the best things you could do. And what's interesting, but within 100 years of Christianity, to have made such a choice was pretty much the worst thing you could do. So the word heresy starts to be described, heresies starts to be used in a negative way, and heresies themselves start to be described as things like a snake, a serpent, a gangrene to be cut out, a cancer. In the words of St. Augustine, heresy is a shit to be voided from the body of the Catholic Church. The world is narrowing, and there is right and there is wrong.
And sometimes I think we haven't broadened our scope beyond that narrowing that began, but that may be another topic. Let's talk about some of the Jesus stories that don't make it. For example, he was playing in the yard as about 5 years old and got himself into a bit of trouble.
Yes, so this is one of my other favorite ones. This is the Jesus Who Murders People. Everyone forgets about the Jesus Who Murders People. So we have this lovely Sunday School and Sunbeams Jesus. But the early Jesus was definitely a lot more varied. And so there's this five-year-old Jesus who is playing by a stream. He's damming water. As anyone who's watched a five-year-old will know, they could do this for hours. And as anyone who's also watched a five-year-old will know, they get pretty cross if you muck it up. And so somebody mucks up Jesus's stream damming. So he turns around and curses him. He says, you shall not bear fruit or something like that. And anyway, the boy withers up. And then Jesus, having done a bit of good work by the streams, and the other odd thing is that he's diverting the streams by the power of sort of some kind of supernatural power. So he's not doing it with his hands. He's saying a word and the water runs clear, or he's saying another word and it sort of seems to change its course. Then he walks home from this stream and another boy bumps into him and he turns around again, this sort of furious Jesus. And he says to the boy, "You shall not go further on your way." And the boy drops down dead. And what's interesting, there's two things that's interesting about this. One is, that poor old Joseph, who's always beleaguered, I feel, in these stories, Joseph, the husband of Mary, by this point, he says to Mary, "Do not let him outside the door, for all who oppose him die." So Mary and Joseph are not sure what they've got on their hands. But what's also interesting is that once you read about this Jesus was very shocking to kind of Victorian scholars and even modern scholars, actually. Even in the 20th century, people were shocked by this Jesus and would be quite aghast when they wrote about him. But once you've heard about him, if you then go back and look at the Gospels again, you realise that there are bits in it that are strange. You know, Jesus curses a fig tree. That's odd. That really upset Bertrand Russell because he curses this fig tree and it withers up. He's pretty rude to Mary, his mother. He says elsewhere, "I am not come to bring peace but a sword." And all of these things that you sort of bounce over, once you read the other texts, these sort of surrounding texts, you start to realise that actually the picture that we've got, it might have been, even at the time when it was written down, more complicated than what we now have.
Well, and it makes him a more complicated person, a more complicated being, and it makes his life more complicated. And as I said earlier, he came into the world, and if he came into the world, that world was pre-existing. It existed before he got here, it existed after he left. And, you know, so it may have changed things, his coming, but it didn't stop the world.
No, absolutely. And there is a sort of blank slate tendency when people are writing Christian histories, you know, Jesus came and it all changed. And that's the sort of narrative and language that we've grown up with. You know, there is AD and BC, there is before and after, like the world changes. You know, Christians in this period would talk about the dark age before Jesus and then the light age afterwards. I mean, these terms get turned around in the Renaissance by Petrarch, largely, who starts to flip it to say, to call medieval period dark ages. But there was this sense that a line was drawn right the way through history. And to this day, you know, we date things by the birth of Jesus. Time turns on a Christian axis. It's impossible almost for us to see history correctly because it has been so distorted by this one event. We tend to assume that Jesus is born and thereafter Christianity is won. And thereafter, this brand of Christianity is run. But it wasn't like that. Well, the way that scholars now talk about this is that there was Christianities rather than Christianity in this period. Also that no form of Christianity might have won, right? Might just have vanished. And the way that somebody described it is like watching a horse race whose result you already know. Like, you don't pay attention to the other runners because you know they're not going to win the race. Your focus is just on the one that's going to win. But it was by no means obvious to people that this one would be the one that won.
What you're saying, and I want to dwell on it just for a second, it's analogous to the replay. You know, you know who's won the race. And so all the cameras are trained on that horse or that runner or that car, whatever the race, the nature of the race was. And you say, oh, there's where it does this, and this is where it does that. And so, you know, you're not looking at history at the time, you're looking at it in retrospect.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. It is the action. We've got one like sort of giant historical action replay that's gone on.
Yeah. Which isn't fair to sort of anybody, right?
No, it's not fair and it distorts it. Hilary Mantel, the novelist, the English novelist, said that history isn't the past, it's the method we have for organizing our ignorance of the past. It's what's caught in the sieve when the centuries have run through it, and it's not very much, is her point. And what Christianity did was it acted as its own sieve also, and it sieved out all the things that it was interested in and saved them, and it let everything else, let a lot run through. And so a lot of ancient texts, a lot of classical texts, a lot of classical critics of Christianity at the time, a lot of evidence of other religions at the time that were similar, these we have lost.
And there was a time of actual battles. You talked about the heretics, and it was easy for a time for an emperor who was Christian or a bishop or a monk to declare someone or a group of someone's a heretic and send the flock out to kill them.
Yeah, so there was a period of violence. You get Julian the Apostate, the Roman emperor, talking about how they slaughter each other and the whole villages were slaughtered. Christianity doesn't record it. And on the whole, it appears that what they did was they exiled people rather than murdering. But they did have these extraordinary sort of internecine battles where they just got this sort of wars where they would sort of just fight, battle, but they're more like sort of civil wars almost. They're that dirty and they're really unpleasant. A war is too big a term. It's in a much smaller area and it's in a sort of smaller location. But you do get some pretty filthy fights between Christians. And again, there's a sort of a group in North Africa who we have some texts, but they weren't translated. There were some martyr texts from these that weren't even translated until the sort of 1950s, perhaps even 1980s. I forget the exact date. And it's really interesting. And again, the translator, the woman who translated those, said, you know, it's like winning a religious war is like winning any other war. You get to write the history yourself and you don't translate the texts you're not interested in. And then you tell the story from your point of view.
Yeah, the conquering powers theory.
I haven't heard that phrase by that.
Well, whoever conquers,
yes,
the conquering power is then going to write the history of the battle.
Exactly. And you're going to write it not only focusing on your side, but you're also going to, there's going to be all these tacit assumptions in your mind. So John Locke, the historian, said of the idea of being orthodox or heretic, he said, everyone is orthodox to themselves. And I think that's a kind of generous way of looking at it, because what you have is not necessarily people trying to blacken the other side. They just fundamentally think that they are correct. I know that when my father was younger, he and my mother both talked about this. They said they would chat about other people who they knew, say friends or acquaintances, and they'd say things like, he's very nice, but not a Catholic. And they would say it with almost a sense of amazement. And that conjunction, but not a Catholic, rather than and not a Catholic, I think that says a lot. And I think you get that sense runs through all of these histories. There's their side and our side. And there isn't really orthodox and heretic. There is in history just winner and loser. And I think that that is the way to look at it.
Yeah, that oppositional conjunction is interesting. And to reiterate, I mean, I just want to underscore what you said, that the winner and loser, I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Exactly. It's not orthodox and heretic, really. A better way to look at orthodoxy and heresy is mine and yours. That really, that's what they're synonyms for. And in history, it's really winner and loser. Who is right?
In your book, you say at the beginning that you're going to resist forming any kind of major conclusions, that you're laying out information, you want your reader to do with it what she or he might. On the other hand, it seems to me, if I may pose a question in that regard, it seems to me that if we take the idea of constructed knowledge and we take the idea of the careful research, I mean, your book is so well presented in terms of footnotes and source citations, and it's just an amazing bit of scholarship. It seems fairly impossible to ignore the fact that it is very informative about this constructed nature of religion as a kind of creation of people.
Yes. So I suppose I didn't want to make a religious point per se, I did want to make a historical point. It is exactly that. I mean, to come back to E.H. Carr, that lovely phrase, we have the bit of the ocean that we fish in. Just all I was doing was just fishing in different waters and kind of offering it up, because it's not that well known. And a lot of these texts survived on a very, very, very slender thread. I mean, lots of classical texts did. Well, not the Bible, not St. Augustine, we've got tons of those. Partly because Christians overwrote ancient non-Christian texts with their own texts. Archimedes almost was lost completely underneath, I think it was a Christian spell for what to do when something fell in your wine. Important stuff. You know, Cicero gets scribbled over with another copy of Saint Augustine. We're losing a lot of stuff. So my point is we have lost a lot, and you should at least try and rebalance the other side. You should try and hear the other side. I think that is the job of the historian, to take the side that hasn't been heard and make it audible and to make it readable. And that was really what I wanted to do in both of them, because these are interesting stories. And I think they change the way you see the past. They change a bit, I think, the way you see and listen to the present when you read things like this. And you realize that there has been a process gone into what you think of as simply the natural order of things. I think that's what I started to realize as I started researching it.
And that means that we're still in process.
Oh, yeah. There's never ending. People talk about the right side and the wrong side of history, but it's like, really, that's like saying there's a right and wrong point to view a rainbow from. You know, really, it's wherever you stand, you will see where you, wherever you look, you will see something.
Right. And you're fortunate if you see the rainbow.
Yeah. Rainbow makes it sound nicer than I meant it to. sounds really jolly. Stuff's not jolly at all.
Well, that's why I say it. You're fortunate if you see the rainbow. What's next for you? What are you working on?
Honestly, I've got my job and we've just got a pup. So I am, we're working on the puppy.
Oh, there you go. Well, that's a very major occupation. And you said you have children and, you know, and a husband and a job. I mean, that's, I didn't mean to imply that you weren't busy and that you didn't have enough to do. I just wondered what listeners might look forward to from you in terms of your next writing, your next book.
Oh, I see. There's nothing in the pipeline at the moment, just having a bit of a rest.
Okay. Well, that's fine. That's very good. I myself will look forward to it. I hope you'll let me know when it's coming out.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's been lovely talking to you as well.
Thank you. It's been great. I really enjoyed it and appreciate very much your taking the time.
Thank you. Been a delight.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback helps others find the show. Be sure to follow us on social media and check out our website at upstartcrow.org for more information on our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of the links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.